KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. President Donald Trump this morning called the Las Vegas mass shooting an act of pure evil.
In moments of tragedy and horror, America comes together as one, and it always has.
That was President Trump this morning, and coming up, we're going to open the phone lines to get your reaction to that tragedy, the deadliest mass shooting in modern United States history. At least 58 are dead and more than 500 are injured. You can call us now at 866-733-6786. Again, that's 866-733-6786. And you can also email comments to forum at kqed.org. That's forum at kqed.org, or post them on our website or Facebook page. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. It's the nation's deadliest shooting in modern U.S. history. According to police, at least 58 people are dead and more than 515 injured at an open-air concert in Las Vegas last night. Police have named 64-year-old Nevada resident and retired accountant Stephen Paddock as the gunman, and we'll bring you an update on the shooting. We'll also open our phone lines to get your reactions to the tragedy. Joining us first is Brett Eastwood. He's a Californian from Discovery Bay who was at the Country Music Festival in Las Vegas last night. And Brent Eastwood, good to have you with us on Forum. Welcome.
Hey, thank you.
Could you describe, Brett Eastwood, for us what you observed and what you experienced firsthand?
Just at a concert like I've been to probably 500 or 1,000 times. I'd even just seen Jason Aldean a few days prior at Concord Pavilion. So, you know, nothing out of the ordinary. You're just at a concert enjoying music. It's probably 5 or 6, 7 songs into it. And next thing you know, we hear this, pop, 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 pop. And, you know, my first reaction is some idiot throwing fireworks like I'm in a Raider game or something. And next thing you know, Jason Aldean and the band runs off the stage. And you're kind of like, man, it's just fireworks. And the next thing you know, you hear this, pop, 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 pop. And you look around and people are starting to hit the ground. And my buddy's like, oh, my God, that person's shot. And then it kicks in. You're like, oh, my, you know, this is real. This is really happening, and we're here. Unbelievable. We happen to be right next to some bleachers, so we kind of hit the ground. My buddy lifts up this fence, like this little metal gate, and makes a crawl space for us, and we crawl under the bleachers. There's about 30 other people under there, just kind of hovering, hanging out, not sure what's going on. And the noise, as you can see on the, you know, news reports, is just – it sounds like this person's right above you on the bleachers. I mean, it's loud. People are screaming. People are crying. My friend takes a – he's got his phone going. Of course, I didn't think about that. I'm just worried, is the next bullet going to hit me in the head? And he's recording, and there's a lady that was shot in the face, and these two guys drag her over to, like, kind of where we're at, and they're trying to, you know, get her near us. And you're 2 feet away from this lady that's literally dying, and we don't know if she made it or not. My buddy doesn't think so. And we're just hovering, and he wants to make a run for it. He's like, I think we should go, and we're arguing. I'm like, I think we should stay. You know, I don't think we should be here. I mean, I think we should just hover. You know, we're under this bleachers. It's safe. His first thing was he felt the bleachers were going to collapse on us because there was a bunch of people on top of them, and we just stayed there for, you know, I don't know, 10, 15 minutes of just nonstop rounds after rounds after rounds.
And I imagine you must have been in a state of what can only be described as terror.
The only that kept going through your mind, you know, is there one person? Is there 10 shooters? And in my mind, I don't know why, I was picturing like a machine, like a bomb or some sort of thing that was in the stadium, because they warned you going in. And I'm picturing, is it like some mechanical thing that's just firing bullets off? Because people were just getting hit all over. You know, nobody knew at that point it was one shooter up in a hotel on the 32nd floor or whatever it was. You didn't know that, right? You just, all you're hearing is gunshots. And you would think a couple of minutes later, the police would take care of it and whatever happens. We're literally 15 minutes under these bleachers of just shooting after shooting after shooting. And then went about 3 or 4 minutes without anything. And then we decided to make a run for it. And once we got out to the parking lot, then we made it across the street to the MGM Grand. There was a lot of chaos, you know, horns honking, people running. One thing that threw me off as I'm walking through MGM, this has been going on, let's say, 20 minutes now, 20, 25 minutes, right? As I'm walking through MGM, which is right across the street, what do you see? People playing blackjack, rolling dice. It was unbelievable. I'm like, how is this going on when I just had to walk over dead bodies right across the street and we're still playing crap?
No, in fact, there was a great fire in Las Vegas, I remember, and people were still staying at their machines. They didn't want to give them up. Really, a terrifying report that you've given us, and one that certainly creates a graphic and vivid picture of what you went through. I'm glad you came out of it, and I thank you so much for joining us. That's Brett Eastwood. He lives in Discovery Bay, California. He was at the Country Music Festival last night in Las Vegas, and as you heard, it began just as an ordinary festival, and little did they know. I mean, they were trying to figure out what was going on. All those sounds and so forth found secure safety, at least initially, under bleachers, but then realized what they had been up against. John Sepulveda is with us in studio, host of the California Report. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Michael.
And I want to say good morning also to Adam Lankford, who's a criminal justice professor at the University of Alabama, author of The Myth of Martyrdom, What Really Drives Suicide Bombers, Rampant Shooters, and Other Self-Destructive Killers. And Professor Lankford, good to have you with us. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Let me begin with our own John Sepulveda, who, again, is host of the California Report, who actually has a history in Las Vegas, was a journalist there for a number of years. This is a concern that has always been true in recent years in Las Vegas about security and what to be done, but usually security doesn't think of the 32nd floor up on high in a place like Mandalay Bay.
No, this is really remarkable, at least the strategy behind this, because where this field was, it's adjacent, it's strip adjacent, it's off the strip, but still accessible from the strip. And it was clear that there was a lot, at the very least, there was intent behind it to cause as much damage as possible, and that's not speculation. That's the angles from which this shooter, Mr. Paddock, had to his targets at the field below. So you could imagine these shots, as we were just hearing from Brett just a moment ago. Everyone started running for the exits, but what they didn't realize is that the shooter was aiming for them as they were trying to get out. So that's why there was so much damage being able to occur from such a long distance. It should be noted that the Mandalay Bay where he was at was across the street from the 32nd floor. That's a very good distance from where these people were. To the larger point, as recently as 2016, the gaming lobby lobbied for the Department of Homeland Security to give them $3 million worth of security funds to stop events like this. And this came after a woman from Oregon basically used her car as a weapon to run down a bunch of people on the strip, or some listeners might remember that. I don't have the exact number of how many people died, but it was yet again another reminder of the danger of soft targets in Las Vegas. This is the city with the most hotel rooms in America. This is a city where people come, and they're generally not on guard. They come to escape whatever is going on in the day-to-day lives. So they're not thinking of security concerns. And it's a city, as we just saw, that is ripe for these types of soft target events. And it's something that officials have been worried about since 2001.
It is indeed a perfect example of a soft target event, alas, and also of something that has, well, an impact nationally because of all the tourists that
right. We
don't know who was hit in this concert, and the names are still compiled. What about the first responders? I mean, law enforcement, first responders, again, remarkably fast on the scene.
Well, there were many so the one thing that is really key to this is Las Vegas has a consolidated police department, much the same way that San Francisco, for the most part, does. And what I'm trying to say is they have a consolidated city-county government structure for their police department, and that allows them to act very quickly. They have made strides to make the ambulance emergency service better. So there was a lot of first responders there, but there was also first responders who were there on their recreational time. And what I mean by that is we are starting to see a lot of police departments and fire departments from Southern California, Central California, report that their off-duty officers were at this country music festival. And that's really interesting.
Police officers and fire.
Right.
Fires as
at
well.
At least three fire department officials, but we do expect that number to grow. There was about 10 to a dozen from San Diego. They're all okay. Jeremy Siegel, who often works on Forum, confirmed this morning that We had one Los Angeles Police Department officer who was off duty shot, is in critical condition. Tiffany Kamhai, who's the producer on the California Report, was able to confirm that L.A. Sheriff's Department as well had been hurt. Jeremy helped on that one, too. So we're seeing this kind of picture emerge of off-duty officers and first responders go to this concert to have a good time and end up, you know, caught in the middle of this horrific event.
How do the trauma centers hold up in this?
Well, the trauma centers in Las Vegas are awful. And, you know, that's really, it sounds like I'm very opinionated on that, but that's just the truth of the matter. Trauma centers have, there's one major trauma center in Las Vegas. It has been roundly criticized for the past 15 to 20 years for being underfunded and not being able to handle things like this. Now, we spoke to a reporter from KMPR earlier today, Casey Morrell, and he was saying that so far it appears the trauma centers, who have now handled more than 515 people at least going to the hospitals, have, in his words, bended, but they have not broke.
There are a lot of big questions looming, of course, in the wake of this terrible tragedy, and we're going to talk about motive with Professor Adam Lankford, who's with us as well. But before we go to Professor Lankford, John Sepulvedo, what do we know, first of all, about the weaponry he had? There was talk at first about maybe an automatic weapon.
So for those of us who unfortunately have had to cover these events, a lot of tape emerges from the scene. And from the sound of it, Michael, it sounds like an automatic weapon. Now, I want to say this with an incredible caveat. That doesn't mean it was an automatic weapon. And it doesn't mean that the person bought an automatic weapon, which it's very difficult to do in the United States. It is very possible that he modified several semi-automatic weapons. We're going to figure that out in a bit. But what we can say is that this gentleman lived in Mesquite, which is was long time known as a kind of a very rural, rustic, I want to say downtrodden town.
And forgive me, also known for being, shall we say, anti-establishment, right?
I would say anti-government, yes.
Yeah.
So, for example, the Cliven Bundy and Ammon Bundy, who they have nothing to do with this that we know of, but they are just moments away from Mesquite by car ride. And you have a lot of anti-government, very strong libertarian people there. That does not appear to be the case at the moment with this person. What we are seeing is a retiree. His brother was, I forget which press outlet, but I saw a video earlier where his brother in Orlando was saying that he could not believe.
He was totally shocked. I saw that as well. Yeah.
And so we don't know what his motive is, what his explanation is. But what we do know is that he was very easily able to get these guns, this weaponry, both in Nevada, where the gun laws are very, very lax. And in fact, private dealers, you don't have to have background checks. And he was able to bring it into this hotel to the 32nd floor.
And at first there was talk about a person of interest, either the woman that he was living with or that he was married to. She was abroad, and it's come into focus that she probably had nothing to do with this in any way, though they may be able to glean some information from her. But ISIS is claiming that he was a convert, and the FBI pretty much is blowing that out of the water.
That's right, yeah. I mean, if a sneeze did damage, ISIS would claim responsibility for that, so you can't give much credence to them.
Again, John Sepulvedo with us is host for the California Report, and Adam Lankford is a criminal justice professor at the University of Alabama, author of The Myth of Martyrdom, What Really Drives Suicide Bombers, Rampage Shooters, and Other Self-Destructive Killers. And Professor Lankford, you know, in the wake of these kind of tragedies, you always have to wonder about motive, and they'll be exploring motive and try to come to them to some kind of conclusion. Your initial reaction to this?
Well, you know, certainly there are different ways you can look at this. My very initial reaction was simply to be I guess, both surprised and not surprised by the tremendously high number of casualties. So this is there have been four of the deadliest mass shootings in the United States. The four deadliest have all occurred since 2007.
Can I go right to that? Because I can't help being haunted by a memory of Newtown, Connecticut, Adam Lanza, who killed those children in that elementary school, because there was some speculation after that he just wanted to top the numbers. He wanted, to be responsible for more killings than any of these other mass killers. And one wonders if that could have been at least part of the motivation behind this killing, because he went to such lengths to get as many people as he could.
Right, exactly. I think that's. I think you're thinking along the right lines, because that's a sentiment that's been expressed by a number of these offenders, including even as far back as the Columbine killers. They talked about killing the most victims in United States history. That was their goal. You do have a perverse competition between a lot of these mass shooters for being the so-called quote-unquote record holder. And it certainly seems like, as your previous guest suggested, that this individual was dead set on killing as many as possible. And the planning and the premeditation kind of point to that as well.
Well, we talked in the last hour about President Trump's response to this, which was somber and scripted. But when the London murders took place, which was a terrorist act, he talked about the loser, and he quickly characterized the person who was responsible as a loser. There is a kind of public perception that a lot of these people are somehow psychotic or somehow have reached such loser status that they have lost control over their senses, and yet they plan these things with such methodical and such almost anal retentive nature. You have to ask what's going on in their heads.
Right, and I think I think you're right. But it's really not a contradiction per se. What's going on is, first of all, a lot of these individuals are struggling with mental health problems and suicidal desires. But that's one of the reasons why suicide is such a challenge to stop, because people can simultaneously be suicidal and irrational in a broader sense. From a philosophical sense, we might say they're irrational. But they can be very rational and calculated in their planning, in their sense of cause and effect, of their plotting to kill victims at certain points, and their calculations that if they kill as many as possible, that will make them more famous, get them more attention.
The media responds appropriately to that desire on their part. I'm just wondering also if you think his age was unusual. He's much older than most of these kind of those responsible for most of these kinds of events. He's in his 60s.
Right. It's unusual, but it's not unprecedented by any means. We certainly have had other older shooters. I think they just haven't been quite as lethal as this particular individual. It's more common with some of these older shooters for them to, for example, attack at their workplace. Some of the shooters who went postal, so to speak, in the 1980s were older as well, but you're right. It's not the norm.
Do we really know? Why or what? I'll use the right verb here. Perhaps triggers this kind of going postal. Because in so many cases, it seems to be there's an attempt to really dissect and to do as much of a job psychologically as can be done, but often running against all kinds of barriers and obstacles that can't be in any way brought into bear.
Right. Well, certainly, no one can read minds perfectly. Often what we have to go on is the statements from the offenders themselves. So what did they say to other people? What anger did they express? And if they made online posts or left behind notes or videos or anything like that, what did they say there? Mm. One of the major themes that I see again and again and again is some sort of perceived victimization. In other words, the attacker actually feels like a victim. And in this particular case, I wonder whether this individual, who apparently had sued a Las Vegas casino several years ago and lost that lawsuit, whether he had felt somehow mistreated or victimized in that case. And, often what we see with these cases is that the individual feels like, I was a victim, I did not get the justice I needed, and now I'm going to go take it through violent means.
Yeah, now I'm going to just kill a lot of random people who have nothing to do with my life or my feeling of suffering or victimization. Fred Wasser is with us by phone. He's a producer at KNPR in Las Vegas, and we have him on the line here. Fred Wasser, welcome to the program.
Hey,
Thank you so much.
Well, you're on the scene now. Can you describe for us what you're seeing at this point?
Well, I'm on a footbridge that's about a block north of the Mandalay Bay, and a lot of people are on this footbridge, a lot of media, too. It's been sort of a congregation point all morning, and it's somber here. You know, people are looking through the window on the footbridge and kind of staring at the Mandalay Bay.
There's a kind of numbness, is that how you characterize it, in the aftermath of this tragedy?
It's very sad. People are sad. The word that I'm hearing most often from people is unreal. You know, I spoke with a couple who are here on their honeymoon from Israel, and they said they're usually on high alert in Israel pretty much all the time, but they don't expect that in Vegas. So they've been very surprised, and they weren't staying at the Mandalay Bay. They were staying at Aria, which is just north of here. But friends started calling and texting them from home, and they turned on CNN, looked out their window, and saw this commotion, and they decided to come down to the footbridge.
Any other stories that you've heard or that you've come across that you want to tell us about from people who are there and are on the scene?
Yeah, well, you know, there were three people, one from Redlands, California, the other two from San Francisco, and they actually were scheduled to get into the Mandalay yesterday, but they couldn't get in, and Motel 6, you know, put them up, and they were just very shaken by it and very sad. In fact, Rebecca, one of the three, suddenly there were all these patrol cars going up the Vegas Strip with sirens on, and she started crying. I mean, it's very emotional for everybody here.
Yeah, I'm certain it is. And Fred, much appreciation for your joining us. Thank you for your good reporting. Fred Wasser, producer of KNPR in Las Vegas, which is the NPR station in Las Vegas. I'm going to invite those of you listening to join this conversation. Your thoughts in the aftermath of this terrible tragedy. We're talking about last night's deadly mass shooting in Las Vegas, which is the worst in modern U.S. history. Again, now the count is at least 58 people dead and more than 500 injured. We're going to continue with John Sepulveda, who's here with us in studio, who hosts the California Report, and Adam Lankford, who's a criminal justice professor who's written about what drives suicide bombers and rampage shooters and other self-destructive killers in his book, The Myth of Martyrdom. Join us at our toll-free number. It's 866-733-6786. We welcome your calls, your thoughts, your emotions in the wake of this. Let us know what you're thinking and what you're feeling. 866-733-6786 is the number to call. You can also join us by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum, or go to our Facebook page. Want to hear what your thoughts and feelings are, and you can join us forthwith. This is Forum on KQED Public Radio. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about last night's deadly mass shooting in Las Vegas, which is the worst in modern U.S. history. At least 58 people now counted dead and more than 500 injured. John Sepulveda, the California Report, is with us here in studio, and Adam Lankford, criminal justice professor at University of Alabama, is with us by phone. And John, can you, before we go to our callers and emailers, can you give us a sense of what we've learned about Californians who were in this tragedy?
So we have heard some names, and we're not going to say them obviously on the radio, but I'm going to give like some of the composites that we have. I heard really just a heartbreaking story of a woman who has cancer. She is currently, as of a half hour ago, being operated on. She has survived cancer twice. She is the mother of three children. She was there kind of as a gift to herself for beating cancer. I heard from another reporter, a fellow reporter here at KQED, Polly Stryker, about a sixth grade teacher who went from Southern California, and the school is now trying to struggle how to, this person has been killed, and the school is trying to struggle to figure out how they tell the students. What we know about this concert is that it really there are several of these country concerts that happen around the country, and this, think of it as like kind of like a Coachella for country. It happens in places like Las Vegas, and they really look to bring a regional audience that's into country. So we know that oftentimes people who tend to be more conservative, and these are demographics by Nielsen, people who tend to be more conservative listen to country, and these are really advertised in heavily conservative areas. So we're looking in California. We're seeing more folks from Orange County, Riverside County, Kern County, San Bernardino County, East County and North County of San Diego. We're seeing folks from the suburbs of Phoenix. We're seeing folks from the suburbs of Nevada, from Las Vegas. So these are folks who really came to you know, put their hair down and their boots on. And this is just horrific.
It is indeed. And before I go back to you, Adam Langford, I want to read some comments coming in. Some listeners concerned about language. Bob writes, don't refer to the shooter as a gentleman. Andrew writes, when discussing terrible things that happened in Las Vegas last night, please use the word terrorism. It is irresponsible of the media not to use this word for all acts that incite terror. The skin color, the motive should play no factor in what we call the act itself. And we're getting a lot of comments about guns and gun control necessity, as you might imagine. Lori writes, we will never be able to eliminate crazy people from our nation, but we can eliminate automatic weapons that serve no purpose in a civilized society. David writes, a mass shooting is just another day in America. Politicians are unable to confront the National Rifle Association, as much as I hate to say it. It's not even worth talking about because nothing ever changes on controlling guns. Let me go back to Adam Langford before I bring our callers and listeners into this. And Adam Langford, I was just talking off air, in fact, with John Sepulveda about a profile that usually often comes out and that over the FBI offices they have of these kinds of incidents and those who are culpable. Often the portrait is of a loner, somebody who's very isolated, usually a male. Not a very good history with women in many cases, even such things as domestic violence and so forth. But there's such a range and so many anomalies to that essential profile that one has to ask, you know, is there a type that we're talking about here? I mean, in many instances, these are people who have no records at all. They buy their weapons legally, as opposed to, let me not call them domestic terrorists, let me call them political terrorists who often do have criminal records and buy the guns illegally and so forth. But when we're talking about this kind of domestic terrorism, is there really any kind of pattern that you discern?
Well, I mean, I think we can look at certain traits. Certainly, as far as male goes, you know, more than 95% of these offenders are male. Those other things you mentioned are accurate for the most part. But I guess it depends on kind of what you want to do with that profile. In other words, like, it's simultaneously true that the vast majority of these offenders are male, and of course the vast majority of males are never going to do something like this. So, you know, when I look at the profile psychologically, I look at three major things, the first being suicidal motives, the second being the perceived victimization that we talked about before, and the third being many of these offenders desiring attention or fame, which can be an incentive for their deadly attacks. Beyond that, though, I guess I would just say there's actually something that maybe a lot of people don't realize, which is that a lot of these offenders, you know, are hard to identify from afar, from the sky, you know, from a bird's eye view, but they actually often identify themselves. So the U.S. Secret Service did a study of school shooters and found that 81% of school shooters told at least one person what they were thinking. What they were planning. The Charleston church shooter told a friend. The Orlando shooter told his wife and actually told coworkers and had been investigated by the FBI. So sometimes these individuals do identify themselves. It's important not to take their threats as jokes. You know, only time will tell whether this particular offender last night had actually, you know, given real warning signs that were ignored.
All right, we're going to go to your calls forthwith here, as I said, but let me first go to Joe Shaneman, who's joining us by phone. He's the host of State of Nevada and Nevada Public Radio. He was also longtime reporter at the let me announce him. He's going to be with us shortly. He's a longtime reporter at the Las Vegas Sun and the Las Vegas Review Journal, and we will go to him as soon as we connect with him. In the meantime, I do want to go to your calls, and let me do that now. Let's go first to Piedmont. Richard, you're on the air.
Yeah, I just wanted to bring up a little bit puzzling to me, particularly with all this talk about we need to come together, we need to unify. I want to understand what the point is trying to be made of enumerating the number of off-duty police officers that have been shot. I mean, you know, there seems to be an attempt in our society to isolate police officers and make them not a part of the whole, but in some way separate. And I think this is something we have to stop doing. They were merely off-duty police officers, people with jobs that got injured, just like the physicians that were there, just like the politicians that were there, just like the garbage men that were there. And I don't understand, what is the point of parsing out their numbers? Sure. They were off-duty police officers.
I think this is, sorry about that, Michael. I think that's a really legitimate point to many parts. We are one society. So there's a couple reasons editorially that happened, and I think we should go through that. One, we were able to find out because police departments released that information. Unfortunately, there's no San Diego County Office of Physicians who can tell us how many physicians were there. There's no Los Angeles County Office of Police, politicians who can tell us how many politicians were there or normal people. And we did mention the fact that we've heard of a school teacher and a woman with cancer. We want to tell the stories of everyone. But the first thing that happens when something like this happens, police officers and others are trained to call their work and let them know that they're okay. And so because of that, there's this reporting. So that's the first part. But there is a significant public safety concern, which is that if you have potentially 10 officers from San Diego County Sheriff's Department who are not able to show up to work because of this or who are indisposed, that does create policing concerns, and specifically in large metropolitan areas. So I totally understand what you're saying about coming together and about not singling out any one particular place or person or person in this place or group of people. But you have to understand that there's only so much we can work with in a short amount of time. So we, as journalists, just like any other people, try to figure out what's going on, link the things we can link, and we are reporting the information as it is available, which is why you should listen to KQED as the week goes on, because you're going to hear more about those folks that you were just talking about.
And we'll hear more from you, our listeners. Steve, let me go to you next. Thank you for waiting. You're on the air.
Good morning. Well, going along with that theme, since we know that there are a lot of law enforcement people involved in this, you think it's going to motivate the police officers' associations to push for gun control because they don't listen to the government doesn't listen to private citizens, but maybe they'll listen to police officers' associations if they en masse tell Congress they want gun control because they're often the ones who suffer the most from these weapons.
Well, there are certainly police who have come forward and sheriffs and so forth who have spoken out in favor of gun control. You have a president now who holds the Second Amendment sanctified.
And there's not consensus. Generally, we see, so for example, after Roseburg in Oregon, we saw that the local sheriff there who's in a rural area was very much against any effort to have gun control. You have this real discrepancy between the law enforcement agents or the law enforcement organizations between what urban officers and leaders want and what rural officers and leaders want.
It really depends. A real divide there.
Yeah,
yeah,
absolutely.
And as you can imagine, as I said earlier, we're getting a lot of responses from you online about gun control. Let me just read a few of these, and you can add your own thoughts by emailing us forum@kqed.org or going to our website, kqed.org/forum. Diane writes, I don't know how people in Congress that resisted gun control can live with themselves. They share responsibilities for these gun tragedies. William writes, who is more irrational, the shooters or those who will reject calls for gun control in the next week or two? Any minute now, somebody's going to say that this tragedy could have been prevented if more people had guns. Elaine writes, there's no reason for anyone to have 10 automatic weapons in a hotel room. Our only hope is legislation that prohibits silencers, requires background checks, bans automatic weapons, and limits open carry and brings gun sense to America. So you can see where a lot of the sentiment is out there. This, of course, is public radio. Do have our defenders of the Second Amendment as well, and no doubt we'll hear from them. But in the meantime, let's hear from more of our callers. Catherine is on next. Catherine, you're on.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call. First, I want to extend my heartfelt condolences to the people who have to bear this burden of grief in yet another mass shooting. There are no words. There are no words left. The point I want to bring up is critical. We don't need to understand who these people are. We don't need to understand their motives or anything else. What we need to do is act. And right now in Congress are two gun bills. One, to make it easier to buy silencers. And the other one is a bill to allow concealed carried guns to cross state lines. For people who are feeling upset and frustrated and who are in grief over this again, I suggest they call their legislators and tell them, don't you dare pass those two bills.
All right, Catherine. I thank you for that call. And let me go back to Professor Langford. Adam Langford, who's with us from the University of Alabama. What about the remark the caller made initially that we don't need to understand these people or what motivates them, or maybe in many instances we can't understand?
Well, you know, I think her point really was that firearms is a bigger issue. You know, with any sort of social problem, you try to attack it from as many angles as you can. So ways to prevent this attack include making sure the offender never has firearms in the first place. Absolutely. But you've heard, for example, his brother interviewed, and it, you know, the offender's brother said, well, I had no idea this was happening. If there was out there someone who could have known this was happening, who could have gotten this individual help, that's another way to prevent it as well. So, you know, I don't think we're kind of in the business of saying, like, there's only one way to stop a mass shooting. There are a lot of different ways. Some are probably more important than others, and I've done a lot of research on the firearm issue, which supports what the caller said about limiting firearms availability. But, look, there are a lot of chances where family members, friends did have an opportunity to intervene, and they didn't. You know, maybe they were in denial. Maybe they were scared to confront. Maybe they didn't feel like they were doing the right thing if they called the police and said, my loved one needs help, and demanded it.
Yeah, but sometimes there have been people who have done that and haven't had the response that they could hope for. I mean, it's not a clear-cut case like Ted Kaczynski's brother who went to, you know, authorities and said, I think my brother is the Unabomber, and they were able to capture him and bring charges against him as a result of that. In many cases, you know, the institutions and the infrastructure are not necessarily responsive and can't be, you know, until something happens. That's often what you hear, yeah.
Well, yeah, it depends what responsive means. So locking someone up takes a very high burden of proof.
That's right.
But on the other hand, improving someone's life, making sure that the individual has something to live for, isn't going to risk his life, that, you know, it doesn't take a high burden of proof to try to help someone make more friends, get more mentally healthy.
All right. And let me go back, John Sepulveda, to you. You know the whole terrain in Las Vegas, and Barbara raises an interesting question and an important one in light of what we're talking about here. She says, we're a nation swarming in guns available to all who want them. I'm so sorry for all the victims of this mindless shooting. This is absolutely devastating. But she also raises a question. How did the gunman get into the hotel? Why are there no metal and gun detectors in hotels?
Because it would kill their business. I mean, that's the flat answer to that. If you imagine having to walk into a casino and check your bag the same way that when you walk into a stadium or something like that.
They said the same thing with airlines, you know. They said detectors will kill our business.
And, you know, I don't know how to respond to that. But what I do know is that casinos really count on foot traffic in specific areas. So, for example, we heard earlier from a reporter who's at that footbridge. They're really counting on people to kind of wander in. to the MGM or wander into New York, New York, where that reporter was. And if you had to go through metal detectors, that impulse that you have to go in there could be delayed. This is something they've talked about after 2001, September 11th, 2001, about how to keep explosives and guns. And it's something they've universally rejected and instead have looked at infrastructure. Another thing you'll see is they have...
You know why the airlines changed, by the way? Because they were,
I don't.
Because of 9/11.
Makes sense. Unfortunately, that's not the case with the casinos, or it's too bad in this case. What I will say is that there's a parking lot attendant at most of these casinos, and that parking lot attendant did not exist before 9/11. And their job is kind of to scope people out and see if people who are parking in the garages or look like the kind of people. Who knows what that looks like, but the kind of people who would bring bombs and things like that into the casino. The one thing I am wondering...
You get into some serious problems with racial discrimination and, you know...
As always is the case when you're counting on looking at someone. But I'm curious how the professor thinks one should... say that my brother... I was worried that my brother would commit one of these acts. Like, how do I approach that person? How do I approach authorities about that? That seems like, you know, a lot of families can't even talk about politics, let alone the fact that their loved one might be potentially in a lot of mental health danger.
Well, I think it's a great question. And I would make parallels. So you said, people have trouble talking about politics. Well, you know, it's essentially, it needs to be an intervention, right? So, you know, there's some parallels with if the individual has a drinking problem, right, or a drug problem or a gambling problem or something else where, yeah, intervention, confrontation, those things are difficult. One thing that can be done is certainly calling law enforcement to perform what's called a welfare check. There have been cases in the past where law enforcement, if they'd just taken the next step and they potentially could have gotten a search warrant, they would have discovered that the individual is collecting weapons or making plans. And, of course, you can also intervene and try to get the individual to seek mental health treatment. But I guess specifically just standing out to me, I do know in the case of Columbine, the local law enforcement authorities had a search warrant. If they had executed it, and they never did, they would have found the weapons, the bombs, and the guns that the offenders were collecting. Mm. And we had a similar thing in the Santa Barbara shooting a few years ago where the offender actually wrote in his journal, "Police came to my house. I was very scared. If only they checked my room, they would have seen the weapons I had." So, you know, it's terrible that this individual apparently was committing such a premeditated attack in Las Vegas. But the thing about premeditation is, it means there's a big opportunity, a long window chronologically, many months potentially, in which someone could have intervened. So I'm not saying any of that's easy. It's not easy to confront your sibling or your loved one if they have a drinking problem. But, the consequences are dire if you do nothing.
And I want to bring more of our callers on. Carrie joins us next. Carrie, welcome. You're on the air.
It's Terry with a T.
Oh, Terry. I'm sorry.
Hi. That's okay. I wanted to confirm what Professor Langford had been saying about various states of mind that a mass shooter would have. I'm a 54-year-old white woman. I grew up in Lancaster City, Pennsylvania, with a father who hunted, and that was my only experience with guns other than. I went target shooting once when I was about 12 with a neighbor, her father, and a few other girlfriends, and it was all gals and the one dad. But I had been harassed myself when I was 12 in seventh grade the whole school year. About the end of the year, after repeated attempts to get this gal and her friends to stop picking on me through, you know, the guidance counselors at school, my parents, talking to her parents, nothing was ever done, and she continued to harass me. I had a dream where I took one of my father's guns, and I went into school, and I systematically shot each gal that had been harassing me for a year. Now, I didn't go through with this. Why didn't I? I don't know. the following school year, she continued to harass me, and I finally did have a physical fight with her. I got the better of her, but that still doesn't negate where my head went prior to the fight, where then it was all resolved. But my point is, most people, I think, do feel victimized because I think they are victimized prior to becoming homicidal.
Yeah, but you can set up, as you did, boundaries or borders that you don't cross over in terms
exactly.
of whatever.
I was young, yeah. I was a kid, but I did have access to the guns. I know my father was, I mean, I didn't know where the guns were. I didn't know where the ammunition was, and it didn't even occur to me. The dream itself freaked me out. Actually, it might be pertinent. In my dream, each time I fired the gun, my arm from the kickback of the rifle, because I had experience shooting a real rifle, so I knew what that felt like. In my dream, the last gal that I shot, my arm blew off myself.
Well, let me just say by way of
myself.
I'm sorry.
But I wanted to recommend everybody read a book, Gavin DeBecker, The Gift of Fear. It's probably out of print, but I'm sure Professor Langford has heard of it.
Well, we thank you for that recommendation, and I'm glad that you didn't step over the line. I'm also thinking about a line of Delmore Schwartz in Dreams Begin Responsibilities. Let me bring another caller on here, and that's Judith from Oakland. Judith, welcome.
Hi. I just was so struck by every time or several times you mentioned this is the worst. I really wish you would stop using superlatives, the worst, the biggest, the most people. I think, who knows, that somewhere out there someone is thinking, well, I can surpass that. I just think that kind of eggs on the possibility of somebody wanting to set a new record.
Michael, you've raised a tough question because it is the worst in modern U.S. history. And so do you ignore that and not repeat that when you frame what happened? How else do you say that it's terrible?
Without just saying the worst, you can say this is a terrible tragedy. But the fact that it's, you know, more than any other, I just think that each time we do that, you know, it's like the biggest. Well, who knows who's listening out there who wants to be even bigger than the biggest.
You're making me mindful of all the things we say that can be a catalyst to who knows what. But I thank you for that call, and I appreciate the thought. Let me go to more of your calls. Let me go next to Razit, good morning, or Pazit.
Hi, yeah, thank you. I'm just calling in because before Columbine, I personally, professionally, think this is kind of an emotional thing for me. I had an experience with somebody who told me he was going to be killing people. And I really, you know, people don't know what to do when they hear that kind of thing. And that, I think, is a serious problem. I have a feeling that everybody says something to somebody. It turned out in this case, excuse me, that he had 1,000 rounds of ammunition. I had somebody available to tell me what to do, and he ended up not doing the deed. But it was a terrifying experience for me to try and figure out what to do about this. And there, I think generally people are hearing indications, they're hearing something. I heard him say something around 3 months apart. The first time it was under his breath, I'm going to kill somebody. And then the next time I heard it, I mentioned it to somebody, and she went into what I call psychotherapist commando mode. And she immediately started instructing me, have him come into your office, have him tell you what he has in mind. And he did, and he had a list, and he had a whole plan before Columbine, but he was a typical Columbine profile, needed a job. If only he could get a job, it would all be okay. And he did get a job, and I think nobody ever heard from him again. But the police told me he had 1,000 rounds of ammunition at home and a semi-automatic weapon. So the reason
you never contacted any authorities, though.
I sent him to the West Side Crisis Center, and I called them, and they contacted the authorities. But I was instructed on how to do this. I was told, here's what you do, and it's sort of and professionally, I was in a stuck situation too. We had a trusted relationship, and there were questions about trusting relationship, what I was supposed to do and not do as far as disclosure. It was a very terrifying experience. But above all else, I bring it up because once I brought him in and said, tell me about it, it all spilled out. But, you know, I might have easily, it was just a one-line thing, I'm going to kill somebody. And once I brought him in, it spilled out, and there it was, the whole plan, the idea, I'll do it and I'll be really strong and then I'll kill myself. And me asking him, you know, is there anything that you enjoy doing? Yes, I enjoy going with my friends. And this, do you want to never, ever be able to do those things again? And a certain psychological disconnect. No, I don't want to never, ever be able to do those things again. And yet, you know, I have a list. I'm going to do the deed with my semi-automatic weapon, and then I'll be really strong.
I appreciate you sharing that story, and I thank you for it. It just goes to the heart of how difficult it is for people who are exposed to these kinds of things. And it also brings up another question I'd like to go to you, Adam Lankford, on, and that is the media's role. We keep hearing about it. We heard about it in the last hour. Your thoughts?
Yeah, well, look, this is, for the most part, learned behavior. It's not like these individuals just have the idea pop into their head out of nowhere. They're learning from each other, and they're not learning because they directly witnessed previous mass shootings. They're learning because they read and consume the media coverage of previous mass shootings. If there's one thing I think I would focus on, and I've done a lot of work in this area in terms of, you know, some efforts that are ongoing to try to make this happen, is to reduce the amount of coverage of simply the offender's name and the offender's face. You know, if we didn't publish the face and the name and reported all the other details about the crime, I think that would make a big difference. And, you know, then people wouldn't be competing for the same way to do the worst or the deadliest, because they wouldn't be getting the personal credit, so to speak, for doing these terrible things.
We will leave it there. Thank you, Adam Lankford. Thank you, John Sepulveda. And thank you also to Brett Eastwood and Fred Wasser, who also joined us this hour. And thank you to you, our listeners. Let's conclude by calling it just a terrible tragedy, which it is, and stating our sympathies and our condolences to those who are suffering in the wake of this terrible tragedy. We thank you for being with us these 2 hours of Forum. I look ahead to actually hearing Scott Schaefer tomorrow from Washington. Thank you for being a part of this morning's program. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.